Welcome to Home Fires Radio Show. I'm your host, Patty Kostelic. With me in the studio today, we have a guest from out of town, Deanne Yamamoto. Did I do it? Okay. And two local friends of mine and employees of WICA, Women in Crisis Counseling and Assistance, Peggy Klein and Lyle Tao. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Deanne is in town from Seattle, actually Renton, Washington, right?
Right, uh-huh.
There's a big difference between Renton and Seattle?
Renton is actually a suburb of Seattle, so I wouldn't consider it a big difference.
Okay, Renton, Washington, and she is with King County Rape Relief. Mm-hmm. How long have you been with them?
I've been with Rape Relief for 2 years. Prior to that, I did some domestic violence and sexual assault work in Eastern Washington, but am rather new to King County Rape Relief.
Could you tell us what that organization does and how many members you have? And
sure. We have two primary focuses, I think. We do direct services, which for us means we run a 24-hour crisis line, and we assist victims of sexual assault and also parents of child victims. We also work with significant others, those who the sexual assault did not happen to them but affects them because it was someone they knew or someone that they were close to. We also do some long-term work in that we run support groups for adult rape victims. The other component of our program is community education, which is actually what brings us here. We have done prevention work with kids and with young adults for quite some time, and that is what we have become known for, although we consider direct services real important work, too.
Mm-hmm. Peggy, WICA does very similar things. Do you want to change or compare or contrast here?
I guess we're not quite as nationally known as King County Rape Relief. I use some of the materials that King County Rape Relief put together for prevention work in my work, which is basically prevention education in child sexual abuse, sexual assault, and violence between people that care about each other on levels from preschool up through about the 12th grade. Mm-hmm. But Women in Crisis has pretty much the same programs that you have. We also have a program called, we have more domestic violence prevention and treatment intervention. We have a shelter where women and children can go that are experiencing violence and abuse in their own homes. We have a program called Alternatives to Violence, which teaches skills for dealing with problems and conflicts without using abuse. And we have legal assistance for people that are victims of abuse.
And we have a 24-hour crisis line.
Right. Anybody can call 24 hours a day, whether it's domestic violence problem, sexual assault problem, or a child sexual abuse problem.
452-2293.
Right.
I know that number. I actually, many of our audience probably know, I am on the board of WICA and have been for a number of years, and apparently I'm going to continue. Made the drastic mistake of not replacing myself. The fatal error that a board member makes is to not replace themselves, and then they won't let you go off. How did you get into this work, Deanne?
Oh, boy, through the back door, actually. I had been doing some volunteer work at a group home for adolescents, basically. And so much of my work there involved being the first person a kid disclosed about a sexual assault. And so I decided I needed a lot more training on this and went ahead and got more training through the local Rape Crisis Center, also through university programs. I was a major in criminal justice and social work. And so between the education and the experience and the expert teaching from rape crisis centers, I was more or less forced into this work, but now it's certainly by choice, but definitely through the back door as my awareness grew and as I could see the need out there in the community, I just continued in this work.
Let's talk about this, what seems to be a new phenomenon, but I think that, in fact, it's been around for a long time. It's just receiving media attention now and publicity, and possibly it's that we have more people who are trained to understand when sexual assault is occurring in or child molest is occurring for children. Do you want to talk about the issue and sort of attention it's receiving?
Yeah, it has received a lot of attention, and I guess that that's good. The attention has been lately on prevention and how we can begin to teach our children new messages so that they can, for one, protect themselves, but also trying to teach mutual respect between boys and girls and trying to get that new idea of socialization out there. So rape crisis work, domestic violence work, is very social change oriented. We believe that incest, sexual abuse, domestic violence has stuck around so long because society and our attitudes allow that to happen. We allow it to continue. And so I think the movement now is to really concentrate on different kinds of socialization for boys and girls, as well as prevention work, teaching kids that they can say no to sexual assault, teaching kids what sexual assault is, teaching kids who possible abusers are. For so long, we've been teaching kids not to take candy from strangers. But, you know, what does that mean? You know, what were the strangers going to do? It was a real vague message. And we're telling parents to be more specific, that kids honestly understand that kind of teaching and need that knowledge, because knowledge is certainly empowering.
It's a difficult subject to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that it is. It's hard.
Is that one of the reasons we've allowed it, because we haven't even talked about it?
I think so. Sexual abuse is hard to hear, and some kids have told, but we've swept it under the rug because we weren't quite sure how to deal with it, and people have gotten to a point where it has become overwhelming, and we realize that we need to begin to deal with it, and we need to be able to hear the unhearable, believe the unbelievable, and go with it and work on it. And that is actually how rape crisis centers began, just with that awareness and saying we need to do something.
Seems like it's real complicated, more complicated than the way we used to look at it, that there were bad people and good people, and if you taught your kids to stay away from bad people, then they would be safe. But I think that now we're trying to put more emphasis on behaviors, and when Lyle and I are in high school talking, or junior highs, we sometimes talk about how, you know, maybe you like the person, but you just don't like what they're doing, and you need to, and little younger kids need to be able to differentiate between behaviors and people too, you know. And we say that, you know, just if someone is touching you in a way that's making you feel uncomfortable, or if someone's touching your private parts, that doesn't necessarily, it doesn't mean that they're a bad person. It just means that they're doing something that's wrong, that's not fair for adults to do with children. So I think kids can understand that, but it's a more complicated way of looking at the world and looking at safety and rights, people's rights.
Before we get too much in that direction, it's an unusual thing for a man to get involved with. Lyle, how did you become involved with the WIC program and team teaching with Peggy?
Well, it seemed to me that it was an unusual thing for men to get into, and I felt like maybe men needed to get into it. And myself being one, I decided to do that, you know. And I really believe that if social change is to happen, an individual has to do it. It's not somebody else to do it. It's oneself.
What is your background, your working background?
My working background is being a cabinet maker and doing all sorts. I've done other types of wood work, too. I came to Alaska doing log work, building log homes, and decided that I wanted to do something socially, so I started working with WICA.
So first you started as a volunteer, and now you're on staff.
Right.
Part-time. Peggy, how did you get into this work?
Well, let's see. I have a nursing background, and when I came back to Fairbanks after working out in the field last summer as a biologist, I was doing volunteer work for Wicca, that I'd done volunteer work for them before. Wicca's always been a special place for me because it's been a place where I viewed as people trying to make the world a safe place for women, and that's been important for me growing up because of experiences I've had that the world isn't a safe place, and getting support from women in crisis. And so I was doing volunteer work there, and then there was a hiring freeze on at the hospital, and I got a part-time job there, and then the child advocate position opened up, and it turned out I did have a lot of background from the nursing background and then my own education that sort of fitted me towards the child advocate job, which is doing the prevention education in the schools. And so I started that job last October.
With declining oil revenues is the buzz phrase of the week, the month, and the year. Very often, not just Wicca's program, but many programs, the prevention education monies are the first to be to fall away because the other crises or the other harms or hurts seem so much more needing of attention, and I don't disagree with that. But is that a situation that also exists in the Seattle area? Is it hard to get prevention monies, education monies?
Yeah, I think it's hard to get because you're right, we're needing to provide that crisis sort of work, the attention to the problems that are going on. In a way, it's inside-out thinking. Those kinds of programs definitely need the funding. I'm certainly not against that. But we do need to start putting energy into prevention. In King County, as far as King County Rape Relief, we're quite fortunate that we have a lot of supporters who will stick by us. Our funding is pretty solid, but we always wonder if it's going to stay solid because of the priority shifts and all of that. And it's hard to do work under those circumstances when you're constantly working against funding sources and worrying about where the next dollar is coming from. A good reason why so many people in this kind of work burn out. I don't necessarily think that it's all the issue that burns us out, but the other stuff that keeps our programs going.
The precariousness of
right. And that whole situation being unstable makes staff people unstable, and that certainly leads to burnout and high turnover.
Don't know if you're going to have a job next year
on
a yearly funding cycle. King County Rape Relief has been in existence, what, 10?
10 years. We're celebrating our 10th anniversary this year, in fact.
You do a lot of work in the school system.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Has that been ongoing for 10 years, or has that been gradual? Have there been difficulties in getting programs in the schools there?
It's been ongoing for 10 years. I can answer yes to that. Have there been difficulties? In the earlier days, there were difficulties. Today, we have problems keeping up with demands as far as requests. That's good news. Schools want our program in their school. Actually, one of the reasons why we've written so many booklets is trying to get school personnel educated enough in this area that they can take on that work on their own. You know, we don't want to have a corner on the market necessarily. We want to spread this information, and we want people to get it out for us. And so that's one of the motivations behind us writing so many booklets, is the demand on us was too much. And it's not, you know, other people can do that kind of work. It's just a matter of re-educating or giving people tools to work with.
I think there's a certain amount of resistance by part of the population for this kind of material to be in the school system. They believe that it is this kind of education about sexuality in general should be taught by parents, that it should be limited to the family. How do you respond to that?
I possibly could agree with that if I felt that it was being done in the family. And it needs to be done somewhere. And so I think that's why so many agencies have geared their efforts toward that, because it's not being done in the family. And it's got to start somewhere. And I think that as we raise new generations, perhaps that message will get out in the family, because they are taught how to communicate the message, how to talk about sexuality openly. I think that as we begin to educate younger people, that might be the situation, that it can occur in the family, which can be one of the safest environments for it to occur in.
Mm-hmm. We're taught bike safety or crossing the street safety and so on. And then that what you're saying is that's easier to teach your kids because you've been taught it, so you teach your kids. And if you've never been taught the details of sexuality, then that's a more difficult thing to know even how to start the subject.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess I'm curious for your thoughts, all of your thoughts, on... We seem to live in a very inconsistent society to me. MTV, many of the cable stations have some very graphic sexuality, lots of images of violence and sexuality combined, and even some of the regular channel soap operas that are on in the evening, well, they're not called soap operas, but the Dallas, the Falcon Crest and so on that are extremely popular have a lot of fairly violent relationships, have in fact occurrences of rape and so on, and that seems to be accepted in our society, and yet to talk about sexuality in a sort of straightforward way is not so easy.
I guess part of it is just the idea about what a school should be, and that some values, some people feel that some values shouldn't be taught in the schools or shouldn't be dealt with in the schools. When we do presentations, when Women in Crisis does presentations in the schools, we always try to make sure that that's an option for parents to, if they want their children to go to the library during their presentation so they can, deal with the subject at home and not have their kids exposed to it in the schools. So that's an option for people. And then, like, King County Rape Relief is doing a workshop this Saturday, which is aimed at parents talking with their children about personal safety, about kinds of touching or kinds of sexual contact that are unfair or uncomfortable or unsafe or illegal, and how to talk with their kids about that. And I think that's an excellent way to go because, parents have so much more contact with kids than this, somebody that comes into the school once a year and has a brief presentation.
Plus, you can do it individually. When it's your own child, you know what that child's mm-hmm. vocabulary is and sensitivity. Are you developing materials for parents, books for parents?
Yes, we have one that's called Talking to Children, Talking to Parents, which is almost in outline form, and a parent could actually flip through the pages one by one, not know anything themselves, but go through the booklet, and the child will really get a clear message as to what it's all about, and kids really do understand what's being said to them.
Okay, it's very difficult for everybody to get to all of these presentations and to have all these materials, so could you sort of go through with us what kinds of things, let's start with some real young kids,
Yeah.
I'm going to presume that most of my audience is, in fact, adult. And
sure.
What kind of things that you
The message we tell kids is very simple. In fact, our presentations in schools last about 20 minutes, and that's it. We do a lot of what-if games. What if somebody punches you and you don't like it? What can you do? Just kind of getting the kids thinking that they can actually react and respond in positive ways against negative actions. The messages we try to tell kids is that their body is theirs and they can decide who touches it. And that they can say no to unwanted touch, whether it be sexual assault or anything, that they can say no and that they can set those limits. And we make sure that we tell kids that it's not your fault if they are sexually abused. I think that the danger in telling kids that they can say no is that you have to reap the side effects that if an assault happens anyway, that they might feel responsible for that. So we make it real clear to them that it's not their fault if they are sexually assaulted. And I think that's a real important message to get across to kids.
How do kids respond to this when you're out there working in the classes?
the way we do the classes is with a lot of interaction, a lot of questioning to them, and they answer. They are very excited. It's real fun to work with kids and see them get it, you know. And for so long, we've kept this information away from them, thinking that they wouldn't get it or wouldn't understand, or that they would be paranoid of adults or paranoid of their father. And it just isn't so. We have not found that to be so at all. That they clearly know when somebody is touching them inappropriately, and we call it the uh-oh feeling. To adults, they call it intuition. You just sense that something's wrong, and kids could sense that. And so we tell them to trust those feelings and do what they need to feel safer.
Are you ever worried they'll confuse that with ordinary and reasonable discipline when they are, in fact, behaving poorly and you're trying to correct them?
I think that that might happen, and that puts responsibility on the parents to be able to explain what the action that they did and the action that the parent feel they need to take against the kids for correcting that behavior. We haven't gotten much feedback, to tell you the truth, on how confusing that message is. I don't think it is. I think kids clearly know when their behavior has caused some disciplinary action. I don't think it's confusing to them.
So you're not afraid that when you teach them how to say no, that a parent just trying to do something reasonable will then be told no?
I don't think so.
I'm just trying to think of why people would be resistant to this information being shared with their children.
I think that kids sometimes will, you know, try that out, you know, see how it works at home. I've heard feedback like that from parents that, you know, that it's like, you know, you're abusing me, you know, and it's like a weird word that they learn, or, you know, it's my body, you know, you can't touch me, type of thing. And like Deanna was saying, that that it's up to the parents to kind of clarify that and talk about, you know, what's appropriate and what's not appropriate. I think it's more like testing the waters, you know, seeing how much power you can get out of a new thing you've learned, maybe.
Actually, kids can make some very subtle and complex decisions, or discerning the difference between real subtle things at a real early age. I mean, actually, before they even speak, they understand a lot of what you're saying and what's going on. It's surprising, in fact.
One of the things, too, is that we're trying to talk to kids who are feeling completely trapped and alone. When we're out there talking, we're not just talking to kids in a normal family situation, but kids who really feel lost, and we're trying to throw out these little life preservers everywhere we're going. So they're ones who are also listening to us while we're talking.
And recognizing it
as
something that they've experienced.
Right. And you see too often, I think, kids really going, yeah, I know what you're talking about there, or I've been there, or I know exactly what you're talking about when you mentioned that kind of thing. And so we're not just talking to kids who are normal or in a
normal, loving, supportive,
right,
protected atmosphere.
We're also talking to kids who are in these rough situations, right, and we're trying to give them some support. And so it is true that kids are going to be testing their parents all the time.
Mm-hmm. I went to statewide conference last fall called Breaking the Silence that was held in Anchorage, and you were there?
Mm-mm.
No, you weren't. Yeah, there were hundreds of people there, so forgive me, Peggy, for not remembering whether you were there or not. At any rate, this is a desire on the part of a lot of professionals in Alaska who deal with the issues of family violence and sexual assault to get together and speak with each other. So it includes social workers and helping agencies, the court system, police, and parole officers, and we try to sort of combine all the viewpoints and combine all the information, which actually I think the state of Alaska does an excellent job of communicating, better than many states. And at one point there was a presentation by five women who were presently inmates of East Meadow, I think that's the name of Meadow Lake. It's the female correctional facility for the state. And there was a really chilling similarity between three of their stories. Three of the women were in for fairly violent crimes. They had They were telling their life story, and the reason that they were asked to be there was to speak to the professionals in the field and to give us an idea of what we might have done to intervene or to have helped them when they were kids that would have ended up in a different result as adults. Now, of course, it's impossible to really second guess, but this was just for our information. And the three women who were involved with very violent crimes, and please, audience, I am not making it, you know, cause and effect, and I'm not trying to generalize and therefore saying all people who are abused are going to be abusive or violent or that everybody in jail was abused. But all three of these women had very abusive childhoods that involved not only sexual assault, but a lot of battery. And just some drug abuse in the family and so on. And they really said, all of them said without any prompting, that they wished that someone had come and given that education at a really early age, mm-hmm. That they needed to know that what was happening to them was not acceptable, and that they remember feeling at a very early age very isolated from the rest of the kids, from the rest of the society, and really didn't feel that there was any good place to carry that information. And they really did very much say that they felt it was them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the parts of the program that Lyle and I do that I feel most positive about is we talk with the students about how they can help out a friend that has a problem like this. What would you say to them, and how could you talk with them? What would make it easier for them? What would make it more difficult for them? You know, what kinds of things would they be feeling? Just to make it safer for someone to speak up and talk to a friend about something, you know, scary or awful that's happened to them. And I feel real good about doing that. And the students seem like, you know, they're real interested in that information too, to see themselves in that role as being able to help out someone else.
Mm-hmm. I think we need to be aware too that kids tell in ways that are kid-like. We can't expect a child that's 4-year-old to go up to their dad and say, Mr. Jones sexually assaulted me, please do something about it. Kids won't be that direct, and we can't expect it. Even with education, they probably won't be that direct. And we need to really listen to our kids. And I think that in our society, as fast-paced as it is, we don't always do that. We don't always give kids the respect and the listening ear that we give to other adults who can articulate what has been going on with them. Sometimes kids will say bizarre things like, Mr. Jones has funny shorts, and we just think, oh, cute kid, and we don't go into it more as far as, well, what are you saying to me? And they really need some direction in their telling, because they're not going to tell oftentimes directly, because that is too high an expectation to have of a child to do, really. So we need to be aware that kids will tell as they tell other things, and it's not always clear.
Okay, that brings us to really a major concern that's been discussed in the press at some length because of these cases, highly publicized, one in Southern California and the one in Wisconsin? Was it Wisconsin? The preschool daycare center sexual assaults, where there was really an allegation made that the investigation of it or the questioning of the children, in fact, encouraged the children to say things that hadn't happened or that were misinterpreted. I want to respond to that.
Sure. I could respond in one sentence and say that kids rarely lie about sexual assault. There will be people who don't believe that. When I say kids tell in funny ways, I do mean that, but they do know what they're talking about. And I think some of the problem, perhaps, with those particular cases is that the questioners need to meet certain legal requirements, and maybe we're not skilled in those areas as far as what is admissible and what's not, and did you put those words in that kid's mouth or didn't you? And that's a whole those are two different issues. It's not a matter of whether the kid is telling the truth. It's more a matter of how that adult got the truth from the kid. And maybe more education and dialogue needs to happen as far as, okay, if it comes down to my questioning of the child, how can I better question a child to get this evidence admissible? Kids know what they're talking about. They know the abuse that's happened to them. They can tell, but they need direction in their telling. And some of the technicalities that happen in those kinds of cases is real sad, because I believe the, quote, allegations that were made by the kids. They just don't lie about sexual abuse. It is very rare that a child that age, that young, could even begin to conjure up that kind of story. And so many of them, it was not just one child, but many children.
Okay. Is the age a special factor when we're talking about they just don't make it up? I mean, is there a...
No. In fact, there has been research and studies done, and for victims of sexual assault in general, the lying or the making reports that are false reports is no higher than any other crime. They say less than 5%, and I think it's actually less than that. But that is real typical of any other crime. That, sure, there's an exception to every rule, but most kids, most adults do not lie about sexual assault. It doesn't get you anywhere, really. Mm-hmm. It's not the kind of thing to lie about.
Well, especially for an adult woman to say that she has been sexually assaulted. In fact, until very recently, and maybe even still to some extent, that really everyone then focuses very, very great attention on the victim. What were you doing? Mm-hmm. Where were you? What mm-hmm. were you wearing? What did you say to encourage it? Mm-hmm. And so actually there's a lot of negative stuff
sure.
that occurs to the victim. One of the reasons the FBI figures that it is the most underreported mm-hmm. Crime that we have.
Mm-hmm. There's another age group where it's sometimes hard for people to believe victims is teenagers, where sometimes the ways that teenagers act out to being sexually abused are by, say, running away from home, maybe being promiscuous, using drugs or alcohol. And then if in the context of that kind of behavior, a teenager says, you know, I'm being sexually abused by my uncle or my father, especially if it's someone in their own family, and there's people from the outside can see mm-hmm. all the family problems, and they think, oh, you know, she's just making this up to get her dad in trouble, you know, or to get away from the home situation, and when maybe it's kind of opposite, turned around, whereas the problems that these acting out kinds of behaviors are real typical responses to a kind of sexual abuse that goes on in the home over a period of time, but it does make it hard for people to believe that the girl's telling the truth, even though, as Deanne says, you know, people hardly ever lie about being sexually abused.
Yeah, I'd like to tag on to that. I'm doing the teenage portion of the training on Saturday, and one of the things I do is begin to brainstorm of who teenagers are. And always at the top of my chart is liars. They're liars. And I think that's true for the most part. Teenagers are really trying to make that shift from children to adulthood, and they're having great difficulty in doing that. And they do lie about a lot of situations. What we find is that they don't lie about the sexual assault, but they may lie about the situation they were in. Were you at that party? Oh, no, I wasn't at that party. Were you drinking that night? Oh, no, I wasn't drinking that night. So although they're telling the truth about the sexual assault, they're feeling like they need to lie about some other things that they feel they might be punished for.
Or have somehow invited the assault.
Sure, sure. Right.
If I hadn't been at that party, uh-huh. it wouldn't have happened to me, so somehow.
Sure. Yeah, and they are dealing with a lot of guilt. And credibility for teenagers starts out pretty low. So when you start to add on, I was drinking, I was at a party, I was out past the time I was supposed to be out. Teenagers begin to make up stories around the circumstances, but not about the assault itself. And we're real sure about that because they're certainly showing very typical signs of a person who has been raped as far as emotional reaction to the assault. But sometimes their stories are inconsistent because they are lying about parts of it. But we really need to not zero in on that, but really take care of the assault, try to lessen their fear of telling, try to make sure they know that it's not their fault, and that you're going to do everything you can to support them, that they won't be arrested because they were drinking, but that they need to be honest about that part of the story, too.
One of the things, too, I think that we're reluctant to believe them because it seems that we don't look around us enough, or we try to block out around us all these things that are going on in our society. And so if we can somehow say this isn't happening, then we feel better.
More in control.
More
it seems
in control.
Safer to
it
us.
It seems safer, right. And then as soon as we say, okay, yes, it's happening here, it's happening to our neighbor, it's happening to my my niece or wherever it's happening, it gets really, we have to start taking on pain on ourselves mm-hmm. and start saying, wow, this is painful society we live in. And it's tough because we'd rather have just that one person suffer than the whole community, mm-hmm. in a sense. We'd say, you take this on, you deal with this yourself, we don't want to. Mm-hmm. And
good point.
It's very painful.
Mm-hmm. I do think that working with college women, it's real clear that they want to make a real simple definition for when the circumstances will be when they may be assaulted. And certainly they want to believe that it is going to be a stranger, that it is going to be in a deserted parking lot, and they are going to have to be wearing a certain kind of shoe that they'd never wear. And so if those three situations do not pertain, it can't be them, it can't happen to them. Do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, well, I think that, yeah, that's a common idea, not just with college women, but, you know, with, you know, people in general, the idea that it's something that happens to by a stranger, done by a stranger, in a dangerous place. In actuality, you know, 70% to 95% of all sexual assaults, from you know kids on up to the elderly, are by people that are known to the victim, either as boyfriend, girlfriend, friend of a friend, friend of the family, someone in the family,
someone you see in the neighborhood,
someone you see at school. Whatever, someone that's you're acquainted with on some level. Most rapes occur in people's homes, you know, not out in back alleys. And they don't just happen to beautiful young women, you know, that it doesn't seem to matter. It seems like things that are risk factors for being sexually assaulted are being vulnerable, being handicapped, being young, being a woman or a female or a kid, you know, things that make it easy for someone who's maybe feeling weak themselves to feel stronger by making someone else feel weaker. It's not the way we tend to look at it.
The recent events in Atlanta where elderly, living alone, handicapped black women were being raped and murdered, that's an example of that. This is not attractive mm-hmm. women in flimsy clothes being in a place they shouldn't mm-hmm. be if they were considering their safety.
Right, and it doesn't make as an exciting news story as, you know, the beautiful brunette who was murdered in New York City. I mean, most rape victims aren't murdered, you know, but that's what we hear about. And
mm-hmm. want to talk about the phenomenon of acquaintance rape? How do you talk about it to students?
Yeah, acquaintance rape. I think even that name, acquaintance rape, is real new to a lot of people. We have said for many years that most of the people who will assault you will be people that you know. I think it's taken a lot of time for that message to sink in. As far as acquaintance rape is concerned, oftentimes we are talking about date rape. That the relationship started out on mutual terms, but it ended up with forced sex. Nothing a person caused, but because because the responsibility lies on the rapist. That whole idea of where responsibility lies is where we've gotten into a lot of trouble, and people are carrying around a lot of guilt, feeling responsible for, first of all, going out with this guy, not having better judgment prior to the assault going on. But we just don't know. We just don't know, because it would be so much easier if rapists had a big R on their forehead or something, but that's just not the case. And because it comes back to socialization and how women and women, girls grow up, and how men and boys grow up, that's where rapist mentality begins, and all of that socialization and male dominance. That's why it's so encouraging to see men get into this work. I love it when I see men getting into this work, because so often rape has been a woman's issue. Well, that's not the case at all. It affects all of us, and we need to begin to do grassroots kind of work in social change, and that's just where it begins. And rape crisis centers continually are putting band-aids on victims until social change happens, but really our goal is social change, mm-hmm. and getting to the root of sexual assault. We need to begin to make connections between sexual assault and social change.
I went to a conference a couple of years ago in California called The Problem of Rape on Campus. And there was a speaker there named Barry Burkhart, who's a sociologist from Auburn University. And he had a friend who was a graduate student who was a very competent, assertive, capable young woman who was raped by an acquaintance. And it had an enormous mm-hmm. impact on her life. She dropped out of graduate school, ended up moving away, was extremely fearful, just a major change, and took well over a year for her to begin to put the pieces back together and start leading a more normal life. As a result of that, because he was a sociologist, he started examining or handing out questionnaires in classes, college classes, regular classes, not to victims who had identified themselves as I am a victim of rape, but to ordinary college populations. And what he discovered, and it has been supported by the research of Andrea Parrott and Mary Koss and others, is that 20% of the college women that he was asking, have you been forced to have sex against your will without your consent, 20% said yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there have been some parallel studies to that, asking both men and women, under what circumstances do you believe that a male can force you to have sexual intercourse? Some of the questions were if he spends a lot of money on you, if the girl leads you on, if you get to a certain point and the girl backs out. It's amazing that many of those, 50% or more, said yes, under these circumstances, it's okay to force someone to have sexual intercourse. And that's a nice parallel to the study you're talking about. And that's a real recent study in the 80s, and that really shows where attitudes are right now, both for men and for women.
And the thing that bothers me the most about a lot of this is that men have this, what I call bad press, about the fact that once they are to a certain point, they can no longer control themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think, the general attitude that men have uncontrollable urges. I really don't believe that's true.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a common myth, and it's something that we use to
excuse
right,
that
excuse
kind of
how
behavior.
We act and behave.
We've sort of put the responsibility, not sort of, we have put the responsibility, partly because of our biology, for contraception and for really the setting of sexual limits on women.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Certainly when I was in high school, guys were supposed to go for everything they could get, and girls were supposed to hold the line the whole time. And nice girls managed to, and bad girls, quote-unquote, didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, we've already set up a real adversarial situation, mm-hmm. when we've said, these are the rules, and you have to play by them. Mm-hmm. We also think, and I mean, I'm just making a generalization now. I'm not saying everybody thinks this, but it is conveyed in a lot of not so subtle ways in our society that sexual conquest is part of manliness.
Mm-hmm.
And I when I say conquest, I don't mean rape, but I mean a lot of sexual experience is a positive manly kind of thing, where we sort of feel the reverse about women. And even with the women's revolution or the loosening up or a changing of sexual standards, I still think that's there to a small extent, and in some places to a great extent. You agree with that?
Yeah, I'd say so. It's men, it seems like in sexuality is the only place they can prove their manliness, in a sense. We're not given other places to say, okay, this is all you have to do to be a man, is to play football. That's all there is to it, you know. Or if you're good at soccer, then you're a man, and we'll believe you. And you can do, from here on out, you can be as sensitive as you want, you know.
If you don't play football, though, don't be sensitive.
Yeah, exactly. If you're only an intellectual and you have no none of the other typical role things that men are supposed to be, then sometimes you have to prove it in other ways that are less, they're not very caring.
Well, it seems like we're giving real rigid kinds of descriptions to what's acceptable manliness. I mean, it seems like a real limited list of things that we're calling manly.
Right. I think that the main attacks on a sensitive man, a man who's caring about what a woman's feeling, is that he's not being a man. If you listen to a woman and say, oh, right, you have a very good point there, you know, I agree with you. And a man standing next to her says, no, she's not right at all. Then the man who agrees with the woman and not with...
It's wimpy.
He's wimpy, right. He's,
push him
he's
around.
Not,
look at this.
Exactly.
He'll put up with anything.
Right. And
well, it's actually interesting in Burkhardt's studies, he discovered that there were very few predicting factors to discover who would be the victims of rape.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, he discovered that they've got a reasonably definite list of who is more likely to be capable of coercive sex. I mean, I'm not... I want everyone to understand we're talking about a spectrum of behavior, and it's not really easy to put the line somewhere on that spectrum and say, okay, this is it, and here these people need to go to jail, and they are rapists and need the brand of R on their forehead, and these aren't. And I think that's what we're discovering. But at any rate, what he finds in the men who are identifying themselves as men who have forced a woman to have sex against her will without her consent, and they have acknowledged this, at least in this anonymous questionnaire, they are men who are mildly sociopathic. That is to say, men who are rule breakers, who believe it's sort of manly to break rules, to go joyriding, to, I don't know, mild crime, let's say, not necessarily burglary, but mild rule breaking. They are men who believe in interpersonal violence as an acceptable way of resolving dispute. They are men who say that they think that relationships between men and women are adversarial. I mean, and that would describe women as sneaky, manipulative, and so on. That they see it as a contest, the war between the sexes. I mean, they are subscribers to that. I don't know how many of those men there are in our society. I really want to say that I think it's a very small number of men that actually totally buy into that picture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess I wonder about numbers and maybe don't even want to talk about numbers, but when we're talking about rapists and when we're talking about people who force sexual assault on another person, we are talking predominantly male. And there are exceptions to that, but I would say 90% of the offenders out there are male.
But that's not to say all of the male population are offenders.
Oh, I mean, no, it's not to say
really
that.
Important.
Yeah, yeah, it is certainly not to say that. and I don't even want to go in that direction, but we need to see, we certainly need to focus on that point and say, well, what's going on then if 90% are male?
Mm-hmm. What kind of message are we sending in society
that
makes that kind of aggression?
Exactly. And I don't even want to equate male with bad people.
No.
Because it is so much of a societal problem.
Right.
That it cannot even be focused on men and their problem either.
Yeah, I think that women put pressure on men to be forceful and to make decisions and to play a dominant role, a leadership role in relationships a lot of times. And a lot of times women expect men to have responsibility for women and to take care of them and to
make
be forceful,
decision.
You know, and be aggressive. And they, you know, they say, okay, that's, a lot of times we say, well, that's what we want in a man. And then when that's carried to an extreme, it means that men are more likely to commit violent crimes, you know, of whatever type. And I think that we need to take responsibility, too, for becoming stronger ourselves and, you know, not being split people or not being a split race of, or, you know, a split species where one half takes the roles of being nurturing and gentle and careful of, you know, protecting relationships and communicating, and the other half takes the roles of being strong and forceful, making decisions and being intellectual, so that people get into this kind of thing where they're not whole in themselves. And I think we all need to take responsibility for becoming more rounder human beings, where we can not be so needy and be able to give out more and just be more whole in ourselves.
Be able to be a decision maker, but also gentle. I mean, that's sort of what you were talking about, Lyle, that allowed a greater range of behaviors and still be...
Right, to allow masculinity and what I call masculinity. I think there are a lot of ways that I am different, say, than from my wife, who I take a lot more risks. I like to abuse myself in a sense by playing soccer or something like that.
Hurt, self-inflicted physical hurt.
Right. A friend of mine said, why do we go out and play soccer? Why don't we just stay home, beat ourselves with bats, and get drunk? You know? But that's what we're going to do every time is limp home, you know. But but these are the types of things that make me feel good. I enjoy them.
You heard it here, folks.
It's true.
This man.
But, you know, that I think that's I don't know, I can't explain it, it's just the way I am, but I think a lot of men do enjoy the aggressive sports and things like that, and to not take that home and say, okay, blow the whistle and say, it's time to go to bed and here we go, you know, and this is the way it's going to be, and I'm going to win, because that's what I want to do. To try to separate that and put it in different ways, or... I'm the man in the family, and this is the way it is, and I don't want any discussion about it. Uh-huh. And if it makes me uncomfortable about the subject particularly, then forget it. We're not going to talk about it at all.
How do you see a change in the young men that you're working with in high school? Is this a hard thing for them to discuss?
It is. It's a really difficult thing because we're... I don't think it's much different, because there are so many societal pressures from the outside, and this is a small movement, you might say. We're not a lot of people out there trying to say it's okay to look at a woman and say she's a human being, and that when she says I'm uncomfortable, say fine, that's great. We'll stop right here then. I certainly don't want to make you uncomfortable. Let's go do something else. What would be good, you know? And I don't think we're trained very much yet.
I guess I just want to underline what you've just said, is the woman also needs to be comfortable saying, I don't want to go any further, or I don't want to do this, and needs to believe that the guy is manly when he takes that no right the minute it's said. I mean,
right. It doesn't mean that we're not going to work on things that are uncomfortable for us, because I certainly feel like in a lot of relationships, you know, growing up, we did things in certain ways, and maybe it left us with feelings that I'm not whole or something like that, and we feel uncomfortable in certain situations. And I don't want to stop people from trying to grow past uncomfortable situations. I think that they should be worked on. But I feel like we should start from where everybody is and not bowl them over like a freight train or something like that.
Mm-hmm. And all of the message here seems to be that we need, one, to sort of examine ourselves and see where our limits are and see what kind of behavior feels good and what does not, and really learn to express that very clearly. First, I guess, to ourselves, and then to others.
Yeah, I think that's exactly the message, that so much does come down to our own self-examination and being able to communicate what we've come up with as far as our sexual limits. And that's a lot of what we tell teenagers, that they need to really begin to think about what their limits are before they're in the back seat of a car and things are going real quickly, and that they're not able to communicate those limits. And we are stressing communication, and that's something, again, that's new. Teenagers now are learning that that is real important, and there's a lot of messages out there now that you need to communicate about everything.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is a lot of what we're telling
Not
kids.
Let events gain a momentum on their own, and then no one's got the courage to stop it and say, why are we doing this?
Yeah, or read my mind.
Or read my mind.
And that communication is a two-way street, that listening is a big part of communication.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's important, too, that in those situations where it's going fast and you're not thinking clearly, it's racing, it's very confusing. Sometimes we feel like if I stop this now, I have to give an alternative which is better.
Mm-hmm.
I have to take control of the situation now, and I have to know what's right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's important that we be able to say, I'm feeling uncomfortable, I want to stop here and think about it.
Right.
Let's wait for a minute.
Good point.
Well, hopefully our audience will think about it. We've run out of time. I thank you, Deanne, Lyle, Peggy. This obviously is going to require some more conversation on the part of society, and we have WICA in town, 452-2293, Peggy and Lyle doing training, and Deanne in Washington, and thank you for coming up and helping us do some training in town.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I'm your host for Home Fires Radio Show. Have a very nice weekend. Our executive producer has been Carla Tonella. Talk to your kids. Listen to your kids. Have some fun in this non-snowy, non-cold weather. It's nice that it's winter's over, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. I like this sunshine.
Have a nice weekend.